Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.
People who are filling in the communications vacuum are the NIMBYs and the disgruntled. When we provide information, when we communicate it in a meaningful way, we win people over because the facts are on our side.
The Inflation Reduction Act proved that the clean energy industry's political power is stronger than ever. Historic incentives for clean energy deployment and climate change mitigation could bring the U.S. within reach of its Paris Agreement promises. Who thought that was possible a few months ago? But we also learned that this industry can still be held hostage, even by a political party seemingly on its side. I'm John Engle, Content Director for Renewable Energy World. This week on Factor This, we're joined by veteran clean tech communicator Mike Casey, who wrote an impassioned call to arms for the clean energy industry at renewableenergyworld.com. It's linked in the show notes. Mike believes that the only way to prevent the next mansion-like holdout is to invest in a communication strategy that prioritizes proactive, long-term community engagement. And he says we got to start now. And later, we're joined by Solve Energy CEO George Hirschman to talk about likely the biggest threat to the promise of the Inflation Reduction Act, NIMBYism. He shares strategies and challenges from the site of America's largest solar project in development. That's all next on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. This episode of Factor This is sponsored by Nextracker. Nextracker is optimizing energy yields for utility-scale solar projects around the world, with over 20 gigawatts of projects benefiting from their proprietary software, TrueCapture. TrueCapture software combines advanced sensing and machine learning technologies to help mitigate energy losses and boost plant performance. The increased power production widens the shoulders of the power production curve, leading to better performance, lower levelized cost of electricity, and maximized financial returns for asset owners. TrueCapture gains are not only predictable and bankable, providing asset owners with gigawatt hours of additional production, but plant owners are also earning over $30 million in additional revenue every year, and that number continues to grow with new customer adoption. See those results for yourself. Find the link in the show notes to download their new free white paper now. Nextracker, solar just got smarter. Well, I'm excited about this one for a couple of reasons. TigerCon president Mike Casey joining the Factor This podcast. Mike is a friend in the industry, so I'm glad to have him on. But he's also the author of a much-read manifesto at renewableenergyworld.com called How Clean Energy Can Prevent the Next Mansion-Like Holdout. Mike, good to see you.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And so the reason for you coming on the podcast today is to discuss what, you know, we've had some time for the dust to settle on the Inflation Reduction Act. That, you know, out of rubble came this beautiful clean energy and climate package that is setting the stage for rapid deployment of clean energy and energy efficiency programs over the next decade. But it wasn't without a little pain over the last year and a half, in which we saw Build Back Better fall three times, I think, at the hands of the senator from West Virginia. What compelled you to write this? I called it a manifesto. I don't know if that's fair. What compelled you to do this deep dive into how we got here as an industry and what we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again?
So I think manifesto is 100% correct. And I wrote it because I have been frustrated for over a decade that we in clean energy pursue policy gains without building political power. And I call it the clean tech public affairs paradox. You have brilliant people, products, really well-run companies, world-changing stuff. But when it comes to how we make our case to policymakers, our approach is predominated with what I'll call magical thinking and principled loserism. Now, what do I mean by that second term? People who are doing things on the side of the angels and know it and have that quiet confidence they are, they will more often than not be blinded to the nastiness of American politics. American politics has been rough and tumble since the beginning of the Republic. It's rough and tumble now. And there's a belief that is not articulated but evinces itself in a number of ways that we can get by with good looks and luck. And it's just not going to hold water anymore because we're scaling to an extent that we're taking real market share from very powerful incumbents. And there's a key distinction, John, that I've seen. Clean energy is not a new industry. It's a set of new sectors within an industry dominated by very powerful incumbents that have spent decades learning how to weaponize disinformation and influence peddling to handle the threats to market share. If you set aside moral judgments about that and you just look at it from a political physics standpoint, when you are going to disrupt powerful incumbents, they are not going to hand you market share willingly. They're going to use the tools they have at their disposal to disrupt your taking of their market share. So in short, either we're going to be at the table or we're going to be on the menu. And it scares me that we're heading into a place of much greater impact when we're so under-equipped to make our own case to policymakers in ways that the policymakers understand.
Well, and that's an incredible statement given the victory that we're just coming off of, the significance of the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, you can't overstate it at this point. It's
huge.
It's industry changing. Even given the last, 10 years have been explosive for clean energy, this is seen as the new gold rush, really. So why then are you so apprehensive about how we are preparing for the future from a communications and policy standpoint?
Good question. So, I mean, we actually start the manifesto by saying we should not pop a champagne cork and put our feet up for the next 2 or 3 years on public affairs. Look, let's take the win. The win is huge. The win is wonderful. And the win came about in the face of our political weakness, not because of it. There are a number of other ways that the incumbent sectors are using government to fetter us. Take, for example, the preemptive state laws bans on natural gas hookups in new buildings. Right there. You've got state comptrollers that are pressuring large financial institutions to not divest from fossil fuels, to not favor clean energy, job creating clean energy. And that's at the federal level. Then if you go to a local level, one of the places where renewable energy costs are going up, and they are few in number, but one of the most prominent places is getting things built. We're going to have to build all this renewable energy, and it's going to all have to be built in rural areas because that's where the land is. And it is in those areas where we are getting a tremendous amount of pushback that can kill projects. And this aggressive, well-funded NIMBYism is becoming a huge constraint on our potential growth. So if you add the inability to build things quickly with the challenges with transmission and storage, you have a pretty severe bottleneck. And the thing that I've noticed over the years, working a decade in politics and then 25 years around politics, what I've noticed is that it's a mistake to underestimate the creativity of the other side to monkey wrench you. So there's 10 different ways that we're not thinking of where our progress can be uniquely fettered. And today's wonderful news, President is going to sign the bill, that should not be a morphine drip that has us just kind of zone out and go to sleep for the next 10 years.
What struck me about the manifesto too, and your action items for the industry was, it wasn't just directed at people like you who work in communications or politics or the trade groups that are based, down the street from you in DC or the greater, DMV area. It is a very, bottom up strategy and action plan that you laid out, saying that, the folks that listen to this podcast, the solar storage developers, asset owners, it begins in those communities where they are and at those town council meetings, city council meetings, or in their permitting process or their outreach to the community. Why is that the first place? And why is it not just a DC problem?
It's a good question. Well, one, because if we made this call to action hooked to national outcomes, what I've observed in really smart forward thinkers in this, in our sectors, they'll go to the resource disparity. They'll say, well, we can never have ExxonMobil's resources. We can't have, we can't have Valero's resources. So golly, what can we do? Well, that's not the issue. Of course, we don't have their resources, and we have a reason we don't have their resources yet, but there is no company in this sector that now has an excuse not to do the basic block and tackle. It is inexcusable that if you have an operating asset, a wind farm or a solar farm that's generating power, it's employing people, it's returning tax revenue to localities, it's generating economic activity, there is no excuse for you to not be proactively communicating from program to that community. I'll tell you a story. Last October, I was up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's in the tiny little town of Garden, Michigan, 209 people. And out my Airbnb window, I could see a wind turbine, so actually four of them, part of a project from DTE. And the Airbnb host and I got to talking, and she's a local, and her husband is a third generation Garden, Michigan native, and he sells real estate in the area. They told me, yeah, you know, this wind farm, it just benefits DTE. We get no benefit here whatsoever. Now, I didn't object and debate them. I just listened to their perspective, but I thought, boy, something's wrong here, because first, I know that's not true. It's Delta County, Michigan. I know that this wind farm is returning tax money to Delta County, but it's on the wind farm owner to be communicating to people ongoingly. So if we have a 20-year project life cycle and we're going to be returning benefits to the community for 20 years, how foolish are we to not have a small visitor center, a local who has been trained to not just take tours, but to solicit tours from people in the county to make it a destination to take a look at? And if we don't do that, if we're not speaking up for ourselves, who do we think is going to save us? The Sierra Club? League of Conservation Voters, the Energy Foundation, those people are fully employed doing meaningful things. They've got a range of things to look at. And at some point, we are mature enough that we need to look at ourselves and say, we can't offshore the basics. We've got to do these things for ourselves. And there is more than enough money and talent in this sector to do that.
Well, and it's not linked to political ideology so much anymore either. This is not just a red and blue issue, given that, you know, you see, you know, I worked previously in Texas, but Texas landowners are very proud of the energy that is generating, you know, money for them based on the land. It's a very Texan thing to make money from your land or your ranch or whatever. And that is certainly not a state that is always aligned with the goals and objectives of clean energy. So it is not just an excuse to say, well, we're in a blue state or we're in a red state, so we won't even try, because the landscape has just changed so much. I'm interested to see where you think generally these communication strategies go wrong project by project. This is not even a sales pitch to call TigerCom or to call any firm, but just like, what is that error that happens along the way?
It's a good question. And we actually have noticed a pattern. So in general, developers of wind and solar farms, this is in general, there are exceptions, are too reactive. They are too light on their use of digital, because many rural communities now are effectively news deserts. There is no local news media that you can engage. And what's left is pretty doggone thin. So Facebook has become the new newspaper in a lot of rural communities in America. And what we've observed, we actually did an analysis of the pushback, the observable pushback that wind developers were getting on Facebook to specific projects, and then how were the developers responding to that on Facebook. And we noticed that the companies, by and large, were treating Facebook as a distribution channel rather than an engagement channel. So in general, if I had several upgrades that I could just wave a wand and make, one, I would have us be earlier, more proactive, more engaged, and I would have us talk to more people than just landowners early on. I'm making these suggestions acknowledging I've never developed a project. I've worked for a lot of people who have, and I have been in rooms where the developer has been screamed at. I've watched those dynamics. But what's inarguable is that we're too shy in communicating ahead of time. And then once we build the project and get it built, we ghost these communities. Now, you know, there's some companies that are effectively throwing turkeys off the back of the truck during Thanksgiving. There, we give a little money here, a little money there, but we have looked far and wide and find no evidence of post-operational programs to track tax revenue. So I'll give you an example. My experience in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan had us team up with Conservative Energy Network, which commissioned a poll in Huron County, Michigan. It's the tip of the thumb. So if you're, that's Michigan, it's your, there you go, tip of the thumb. It has the highest density of wind turbines in the state. It has 33,000 people that voted for Trump, I think almost 70%. So it's red, it's rural. It's quite content with how things are going in Huron County. It doesn't like the direction of the state, doesn't like the direction of the country. But what you notice is that over time, the ability to build new renewable energy capacity in Huron County has gone down because objections have gone up. So we use this very innovative polling method called dynamic online sampling. It allows you to go deeper at less cost with greater accuracy in a small area. And we found that, incredibly, the number one thing people wanted from renewable energy in Huron County was what renewable energy was already delivering, which is tax revenue that go to pay for a stadium for the high school, a parking lot, to repave a road, or a science lab at a high school. It was doing these things, but people didn't know. So when you start the poll, you had a negative 5 or 6% favorability rating for the industry. People said, by and large, we're unfavorable to this sector, with one question that detailed specific things that the industry had paid for through its tax revenue. Support swung 14 points, went from 5 negative to 9 positive. One question. I have read hundreds of political polls in my time. I've written them. I've been in rooms with focus groups. You have to typically use batteries of questions to get people to move 14 points in a poll. This moved in one, which tells us that we're in a community that needs the economic foundation that we provide. We're doing what it most wants us to do, and yet people who are filling in the communications vacuum are the NIMBYs and the disgruntled. When we provide information, when we communicate it in a meaningful way, we win people over because the facts are on our side. So I think the way to see the manifesto is it's a message from a fervent supporter and someone who's devoted his life to promoting the well-being of these sectors, saying, we are way better than how we're performing in public case-making.
Do you think we're in this predicament in part because we're just building so many projects at this point?
Hey, Factor This listeners, it's John Engel. I wanted to let you know that you can now watch every new episode of the Factor This podcast on YouTube. Just search Renewable Energy World and leave a rating and review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
I don't have the confidence to tell you that I know what drives us to our current situation. I have suspicions. I'll offer mine. And I suppose that at some level, the why doesn't matter nearly as much as what we're going to do about it. Our conclusion is that the major developers they come from utility DNA, particularly on the wind side. EDP, EDF, E.ON, now RWE, etc. They all came from European utility heritage. And I suspect, though I do not know, that when social media came on the scene, it was viewed by aging executive teams as kind of like a box you need to check. So they started checking a box. And at some point, the messiness of social media, it's cacophonous, it's messy, there's trolls. You don't keep control of your brand narrative very easily. It got messy and people constrained how they wanted to engage on these platforms, which from a global brand perspective makes sense, but it functions as a set of handcuffs when you need to use these platforms to agilely communicate with your constituent communities. It's like, for example, if I was going to develop a project, I would use Facebook to engage not just the landowners, but I would engage county development officials. I would in the local business community, who I'm going to buy coffee from, pizzas from, rent hotel rooms from, rent vehicles from, get hardware from, etc. I would broadly define our supply chain and engage them and say, you sure you want us here? Yes, we would like you to come here. Because in a lot of these rural communities, they've got nothing. They got Walmart, they got some farms, they got county government, and that's kind of about it. Because, you know, I come from the Rust Belt, and I can tell you a lot of these communities, there's a sense that better days are behind us. We are offering hope for better days ahead of us. And if we can engage a group of people that's beyond just the landowners and say, we can meaningfully drive a different economic future, then we're equipping the community to have a intra-community conversation about what their economic future is going to look like, as opposed to locals rebelling against an out-of-state or foreign company. And I think that if you've been in rooms and seen developers getting shouted at and screamed at and called a bunch of names, and county officials being bullied or threatened with recall or physically threatened, you know, the few times I've been there, I've seen it. It's ugly. That ugliness doesn't go away. But if there's a group of people in the community beyond just the landowners who are saying, yeah, we want this, we really want to look at this as an option, then the NIMBYs aren't launching the attack at an out-of-community outsider company. They're forced to have a dialogue with their neighbors.
If you like what he has to say, Mike Casey, the president of TigerComm, has his own podcast called Scaling Clean, where he talks to executives in the clean energy industry. And he's available on all your social media feeds too. So he's a fun follow on LinkedIn. Mike, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
John, thanks for having me. This is great.
Our next interview is brought to you by Rolls Battery. Available in popular BCI case sizes, Rolls R Series 12-volt and 24-volt LFP lithium models offer a maintenance-free, lightweight flooded, and SLA alternative designed for true drop-in replacement with fast charge-discharge capability, built-in BMS with operating protections, up to 4x series and 4x parallel connectivity for 48-volt system configuration, and exceptional cycle life, delivering more than 6,000 cycles at 80% depth of discharge, and backed by a 3-year full replacement manufacturer warranty. Visit RollsBattery.com to find a distributor near you. Now we're pleased to welcome George Hirschman. He is the CEO of Solve Energy, an engineering, procurement, and construction firm that works on utility-scale solar and storage projects in North America. Also does some O&M work. George is also the board chair of the Solar Energy Industries Association trade group. George, welcome to the Factor This podcast. Great to see you.
Well, thank you, John. Appreciate you having me.
Of course. I really wanted to talk to you about in having this conversation about, you know, the political might of this industry and the responsibility and role that we have in communities that we partner with. The Inflation Reduction Act is going to unlock a scale and speed of deployment that we've not seen before because of that certainty, because of those incentives for production and for manufacturing. How do you view the role of both EPCs and developers and all the stakeholders that we have in the value chain in making sure that the communities we're partnering with have a good experience with us, not just pre-commissioning, but beyond that as well?
Yeah, and I think this is an important part of the discussion and something that we have focused on as a company with Solve Energy, but also as an industry. And we recognize that, you know, we are coming into communities oftentimes for the first time. A lot of people don't understand what solar is. And any large construction company and, you know, you're creating change in a local environment. And so education is key to a lot of it, right? Is getting into the projects early and the locations early and explaining to the local community the great opportunities that solar brings in a job creation opportunity, but also, you know, how you're going to be a good steward in the community for a long time. These projects run for 30 years and, you know, but you have kind of a concern that what happens when my community that never had power generation in it before is now going to have essentially a utility scale power plant. And what does that mean, right? Does that look like, you know, we're creating new fence line communities where, you know, we've had historical health problems and pollution and other things around energy generation? This is completely different than that, right? After we built these plants, most people don't even recognize them in their communities anymore, right? They just kind of blend in. You're talking about a solar plant that's 4 feet high at its highest point oftentimes. And so they're just not the disturbance long term that other forms of power generation have. So I think that a big part of it is just the education process. We've done a very good job of it over the years, and because we've built 250 projects, so this is not new to us. It's really something that's kind of built in our DNA. We have a big community relations arm within our organization. We do a lot of work in a number of communities where we have built projects in the past. We always go into areas where we're building projects now and try to build some relationship, understand what their needs are, understand where we can be helpful. And it's not just in job creation. Sometimes it's in local community events, places where they need support. Probably the best example and lasting example we have is the work that we've done for the Navajo Nation, where we've built two projects within the nation, and we've stayed there continuously since we've built the first project. And we made a commitment to them that we would be involved in the communities long term. And we've stayed there. We stayed there through COVID, doing distance learning kits for kids that couldn't go to schools. We are out there doing a what we call Skip the Grid, which is a program that provides battery and solar panels to houses that don't have electricity so they can get kerosene lighting out of their homes because of the indoor air quality issues. And these are homes that have never had electricity. So we have a commitment to do that. And we go back every year and do homes and work closely with the school district. So, you know, we take those kind of examples and do them in communities in which we work, whether we're working with local school districts, community centers, really to kind of spread some goodwill, as well as we're explaining the benefits of renewable energy and the opportunities that this industry has. It's not just construction jobs, right? We employ across the gamut of skill set. As you can imagine, we have engineering groups, we have a purchasing department, we have legal department, we have marketing and PR. There's every aspect is represented within our organization. And we try to share that information out to communities in which we work. So as we get bigger, we're going to have to do more of it as an industry.
Yeah. And I wonder what your perspective is also on the challenges with just the scale of the individual businesses in having those relationships at a very granular and local level. Solve is obviously very established. You have a big team. Those commitments to communities are not small investments either. They take manpower. They take money. Some of these development shops that we know have fairly small teams. I mean, 5 to 10 people. What would your advice be to groups like that, that are more going project to project, that don't have necessarily the funds to set up shop in a community long term, to still have meaningful relationships, to really enhance the relationship that we as a overarching industry have with all of these communities, not just city by city? What would you say?
Yeah, I think that, no project is too small to get community support and to do the small things. Every project can, and every company, large or small, can do something. We've been lucky enough to grow our business and to be able to do this at a larger scale. But, you know, across every project, we do it at some scale. And so I think it's important for companies just to realize that, you know, they're guests in these communities, and they need to build support and a relationship with these communities, because these projects will be there for a long time. So even if you're doing a rooftop job for a community center or for a library, there are small things that you can do to support that facility and support that that community. It doesn't take these large programs. It takes, small things, right? Neighborhood cleanups, support, we've supported a lot of little league programs, right? Where it didn't cost much, We were there. We got a banner up in the outfield. People recognized who we were as an organization, that we were in the neighborhood, and we got ourselves connected. So I don't think it has to be big things, right? I think people have to realize that that community is based from a lot of, you know, just a lot of small things and a lot of involvement. Like, get your, have your project teams get themselves involved and hire local people that are already involved, right? That's where our best ambassadors in these communities are from neighbors. I mean, from employees that we hire onto a job that work in the community and then say, oh, by the way, I work on that project and it's a good job and it's a, it's, you know, it's a safe environment. And, you know, this is a great opportunity to build a career in an industry. And so, you know, I encourage everybody to look at your, the communities in which these projects are being built and hire people within those communities. It's, you talked about, you know, our O&M group. Well, our O&M group is a significant part of our business. And you know, it is a great opportunity to create a job that will stay on that project and somebody that will work for, you know, the next 10 years operating that plant in their own community. And so that really brings an attraction to the project that is not just a, not just, you know, we come in, we hire 500 people, we build a project, and a year later we're gone. It's the fact that we keep, you know, a number of those folks on site and they go to work in their own communities for a decade.
Let's talk about the aptly named Mammoth Solar Project that sure. Solve is working on with Doral. When it's finished, expected to be around 1.3 gigawatts, that would make it believed to be, I think, the largest solar project in the U.S., a $1.5 billion investment. We're talking 13,000 acres, two counties in Indiana, and 60 landowners. When we talk about community engagement, that might be the best case study that we have to date on getting people on board, keeping them on board, and forming a plan for the long-term cooperation with those families, really. Interested to hear both sides of the equation, because I know it doesn't always go perfectly. And the point of this podcast is in many ways to serve the industry with helpful information that isn't always the easiest to talk about. So I would like to hear about how you've approached those difficult conversations that maybe didn't go as well in the beginning, and then maybe some of the better examples of we made it work in a productive and positive way, or turn something around.
Well, I think that's a great example of just the size and scale of projects that we're dealing with now and the amount of stakeholders.
That was a whole portfolio pipeline, yeah. You know, it still is. A 1 gigawatt pipeline is something to be
exactly.
happy with.
No, I mean, it took us 8 years to build a gigawatt of solar as a company. Yeah. And now, you know, now we're building, you know, 4 or 5 a year, but we're, you know, we're seeing projects that are a full, you know, over a gigawatt. So, and that will be the largest, but it will not remain the largest in the U.S. There's no way, right, that we're just going to see projects continue to grow and there's just huge opportunity. And so, you know, I think it is a unique example of where you have to do the education. You have to bring in the stakeholders. This is not only a big project, but it is not a historical solar kind of knowledgeable area, right? Indiana is not Central California, where we've been building projects for 15 years. And so, I mean, I talked about the education process, being able to go into the communities and explain to them what the project is, what it's going to be, what the impacts and what the benefits for the community are. It hasn't been perfect. I mean, there are, you know, there with that many stakeholders and neighbors and communities in which you're impacting, you're going to have some detractors that you're going to have to deal with. And some of them, this is new to our industry, and I think something that we all have to be aware of and kind of understand, because we were just a small industry for a long time, and the incumbents, oil and gas industries and coal, that are, you know, well funded and well established, have been there for a long time, and now we're starting to gain their market share. The more we grow, the more it takes away from someone else, right? The demand for energy in the U.S. is growing, but not at the same scale that renewables are displacing the traditional oil and gas and coal industry. So that means that they're losing market share as we gain market share. And so the attacks that come from those incumbents are going to be better funded. They're going to be more attacking. They're going to be doing things that we were never used to, because nobody attacked wind and solar when it was 3% of the energy portfolio. No one really cared, right? Because it was just, we were a nuisance. Now we are a threat. As you become a threat, they're going to get more aggressive. And so I think the challenge for companies like ours is to recognize where the negative, you know, comments or, you know, feedback that we might get, what looks like it's coming from the community, may not actually be coming from the community as a whole. It may come from well-funded, placed operatives that are trying to detract from what we're doing. Your initial reaction is to fight back a little bit. And what you need to do is just really be mindful of where those detractors are coming from and figure out if you can combat them in different ways, right? You can kill people with kindness versus directly fighting those battles. And because I think uniformly we have support in neighborhoods where we work, I think you're always going to have some people that are just not going to like change, and they're not going to like traffic, and they're not going to like all the things that come with construction. There's going to always be some battles around the way that the workforce is made up. In some areas, we are all union because there's union established infrastructure. California, in some areas, we don't have that. So there's always a push and pull around, do we have the infrastructure in place to go union? Do we not have the infrastructure in place? Therefore, we would be importing employees. And that's not supporting the local workforce. I think that's what the IRA did really well, which is established a prevailing wage program that works in every state, in every region. So if you don't have union infrastructure to support a project, you still have prevailing wage that pays good, strong wages to employees that you hire locally, and you have training obligations through apprenticeships. So, you know, I think you're always going to have that push and pull, right? This is no different than any other, you know, large construction. If you think about big civil jobs or you think about urban construction, you're always going to have those challenges with projects. It's just much more high profile now because of the size of the jobs. And we now have the attention of the power incumbents that are fighting a lot harder than we ever had before.
How about the tricky balance of doing that proactive education while also operating in somewhat of a stealth mode that we know that, you know, as this industry has grown up, it's becoming tougher and tougher to find those good pieces of land, and you do have to operate quietly in the beginning in some scenarios to meet the necessary stages of project development. You don't want to tip your hand too early. So we talked about that with Mike Casey in the interview before, but there's that tricky position in telling a community, hey, we're coming in, we're looking at building a solar project here, we'd love to work with you in making it the best project possible, and also not giving away all of your cards to the other utility scale developer that's also looking at Indiana or Ohio or North Carolina or wherever. How do you play that balance?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that is something that we talk to our our developer partners about a lot. When we start to look at their portfolios and where they're, you know, looking at different opportunities, we always ask that we get brought in as early as possible with them, and recognize that there's a point in time where, you know, it's the right time to, for us to get involved, because, you know, by nature, we don't want to be stealth, right? We want to come in and have, you know, the jobs are close enough where we can come in and have job fairs and other things that, you know, that they're not ready to have. So when it gets through to a point where they're down to, you know, either final CUP approvals, things that they're, you know, they have the project in hand enough that it's time to shine the bright light, then it's time for us to get involved. I think that there is a delicate dance that happens on the developer side, and they, you know, they do it really well, and they keep us out as much as we can until they recognize that getting us involved is an important part of winning over the hearts and minds of the community. Because at the end of the day, they can say they're creating jobs. We actually are hiring people, right? So there's a difference.
Yeah, you're oftentimes the EPC is that first touch point to the community in the most like tangible way.
Sure, because there's not, you know, unless communities are, and you have very active members within the community, they might not know of, you know, a project that's going through an approval process or something that has little or no impact to them directly. I think where they often find out is when we come in and months ahead of time and have a job fair where we'll actually explain the job, explain the opportunities and those things. And sometimes that's the first time people ever heard about it. So I think there is a balance there, but I think if done right, it's always better to get in early. We say kind of, and send some of our teams that are not our project teams, right? Send our community relations teams in and send, you know, the teams in that have the ability to soften the ground before we fully land, right? So do some things in the community, say we're coming before we start to send our, you know, our talent development teams that are going to come in and do job fairs and hire people, send other kind of operatives in to do, you know, to do some work around the communities ahead of time. And I think we're doing a better job at that now. We're using our community relations team to be more proactive than reactive. I think for a long, it's kind of natural that they become reactive. You have a job, you want to, all of a sudden you want to build some goodwill. You're already there.
Or it's crisis, which is part of this. And they have to go in and tamp down those rumors that are started by, you know, bad actors, right, like you mentioned.
And I think that we are, you know, we're learning that too. This is a unique time for this industry and for really a industry at all in the U.S. that's becoming this disruptive to something that is so incumbent. And so I think we're all learning a bit of what we can do better. And some of those things, you know, because we're so kind of mission focused and project focused, and developers are, and we are, what we have to realize is that that is just not the industry we're in anymore. This is a long-term sustainable industry that we have to start to act differently. And I think getting in and using our teams more proactive in the environment, in the communities, will serve us all better.
George Hirschman, Solve Energy, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of Factor This from Renewable Energy World. And thank you to Nextracker and Rolls Battery for sponsoring this episode. Factor This is a production of Renewable Energy World and Clarion Energy. Join us every Monday as we break down solar's most important topics with industry leaders who actually move the needle. And please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factor This from Renewable Energy World.
Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.